Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Tracy Borman talking about the 16th and 17th century witch craze.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to my talk. I understand this is your last one of the day, so well done, and I hope you've learnt lots already. Well, I'm going to be talking to you briefly this afternoon about the witch craze, and in particular, the early 17th century, when it reached a definite spike in England and Scotland under the auspices of King James I. Well, I first developed an interest in the witch hunts when I was teaching at university, so it's quite a few years ago now. And I often just blithely say I taught witchcraft at university, and it can be misconstrued. So I very much taught the history of the witch hunts. And I was always struck by the scale of this movement. I mean, it's called craze for a reason. It swept across Europe almost from a standing start in the 15th century, and it continued to blaze until the middle of the 18th century. What on earth started it? What did it mean? I'm going to try and explore some of those things this afternoon. But it led me, this fascination with witch hunts and witchcraft, it led me to write a non-fiction history of the witch hunts, in a shameless plug, of course, for my book, Witches, James I and the English Witch Hunts. And this book focuses on a particular witchcraft trial that took place in my home city of Lincoln. And I'll tell you a bit more about that. But it looks at that as a sort of jumping off point for the witch craze as a general movement. Well, when I started my research, I had quite a stereotypical image in my mind of what a witch was or is. So if you think about Halloween every year, and the most popular item of fancy dress is that of a witch. And it's the pointy hat, isn't it? And the kind of the hooked nose, the black dress, the broomstick, the cat, all of those things. And I had thought that this was a Hollywood construct, really, a Hollywood image of a witch that had pervaded popular culture. And I was astounded by just how authentic that image actually is. You can see here, this is a woodcut from the 17th century, and it shows a witch in the center. And you can see it's pretty much as I've just described. So our modern idea of what a witch looks like is very much based in history. But I say history. This is based from when witches suddenly went from being good to evil. I don't know if anyone's seen the musical Wicked, but it has resonance this afternoon, because witches have been around for centuries. So they're referenced in the Bible, they're in Greek mythology, but for much of their history, actually for several centuries, they were definitely a force for good. They were, if you like, white witches. They were seen as mostly women, but there were men as well, who could heal members of their local community, who could tell fortunes and help people make decisions in life, who could even locate lost property. That was one of the main advantages of a witch. And then everything changed, and it changed quite suddenly and quite dramatically. In around the middle of the 15th century, when suddenly being a witch was something you didn't want to shout about. And the reason was it became synonymous with heresy. It was a crime against God, so the church had decided. And there was a papal bull against witchcraft published in 1484, by Pope Innocent VIII, who really did spark the witch craze that dominated European history for the next 200 odd years. Why on earth did he think
that witchcraft was suddenly so evil? Well, I think there is a very valid theory that, in fact, what the Pope was doing was reacting to the rise of female power in society. Women had traditionally been relegated to second-class citizen roles, really, in society. But with the rise of monasticism and with the age of female regents in the early Middle Ages, they had enjoyed greater authority. And the church felt deeply uncomfortable about this. And I think the witch craze was a very cynical attempt to put women back in their places. And it worked. Suddenly, it was terrifyingly easy to find yourself accused of witchcraft. Now, I'm going to recommend to you a Horrible Histories sketch. I am a great fan of Horrible Histories. They often nail it, as far as I'm concerned. And this is a sketch, if you look it up on YouTube. Witch Finders Direct. You know, got a witch in your local community, we'll come in and find her for you. And they go through a checklist of what they're looking for. So, female, top of the list. Most suspected women, sorry, witches were female. About 80% were female. Single, you were deeply suspicious if you were female and unmarried. Even if you were widowed, that was seen as something to be worried about in society. You were poor. You lived on the periphery of your community. You didn't fit in. You were probably not very popular with your neighbours. And last but not least, you were probably a cat owner, because cats were the most popular type of familiars. These were animals that were seen to help witches in their evil work. So you can imagine how easy it was. Many, many thousands of people fitted the bill as a witch. And even more terrifyingly, you didn't need any evidence in order to bring a suspected witch to trial, because what evidence could there be of witchcraft? You could just say, she cast a spell on my flock of cows. Is that the right flock of sheep? Herd of cows or flock of sheep. Anyway, she did that bad thing, and therefore she's a witch. Nobody can say she didn't do that. And so it's very easy to go from accusation right the way through to the court of assizes, where most suspected witches were tried. But the more conscientious witch hunters did take the trouble of administering a number of tests to make sure that the person suspected of witchcraft really was guilty before they went to court. And these tests took various forms, but the two most popular were to swim a witch. And now this involved, you can see on the left, you would go to your local pond, if it was deep enough, or lake or river, and you would throw the suspect in. And if she sank, she was innocent. Whoops. If she rose to the surface, she was guilty and would probably go on to be hanged. Well, it wasn't quite as unfair as that, because they would, as you can probably make out, tie a rope around the suspect's waist. And if it looked like she wasn't going to rise to the surface, they would haul her up. Often, though, not quite in time. Many suspected witches drowned in this way. A more horrific test for witchcraft is demonstrated by those rather grisly-looking instruments on the right. And I'm told that you have strong stomachs, you lot, so you can stand the description that follows, which is about witch pricking. And so a witch pricker was a professional job, and what they did, where they would come along and they would examine the accused. Because it was believed that when a witch became a witch, she made a pact with the devil. And the devil marked her as his own. And he left a mark that looked very much like a mole or a freckle or something like that. But the devil's mark was special, because when it was pricked or stabbed, really, it didn't cause any pain. So the witch pricker would go over the accused body and literally kind of stab her over any little mark on her body until she stopped crying out in pain. And then he would say, ah, found it, there's the witch's mark. The fact is, she'd probably fainted away from all the pain of the previous stabbings, but that was taken as evidence. So it was horrific. Even if you managed to get acquitted, really just that what you'd have had to have suffered to get to this stage would have been absolutely abysmal. And the numbers are just bewildering. So between 1450 and 1750, there were no fewer than 100,000 people on the statute books accused of witchcraft. Of those 100,000, about 40,000 went on to be executed. Well, it's horrific enough as a statistic, but actually the real numbers were probably much, much higher, because those numbers are just drawn from the surviving records, and most records have been lost for witchcraft trials. And then also, as well as the official trials, you get sort of forms of vigilante justice, really, back in local communities where there are just summary witch hangings by members of the community. They don't bother to go through the courts of law. So we're probably talking about hundreds of thousands of witches who lost their lives. Well, by the advent of James I's reign in 1603, upon the death of the last Tudor monarch, Elizabeth I, the witch craze was starting to die out, at least in England, where we were starting to question whether witches really existed at all. Not so James. He had brought forward such an obsession with witches during his years as King of Scots that he was determined now to introduce this obsession into England as well. So as soon as James became King of England in 1603, you see a huge upturn in the number of accused witches coming through the court records once more. And it was a very, very dangerous time to be alive. But why was James so obsessed with witchcraft? Why was he so convinced that witches really existed? Well, the story goes that it all originates from his marriage to Anne of Denmark, because what happened was the marriage had been contracted in 1589, and James was waiting for his bride to sail across the North Sea to Scotland, where he was waiting to greet her, except she never arrived because her fleet had been battered back by violent storms. So in an uncharacteristic, I have to say, gesture of bravery, James decided to go and get his bride himself. So he assembled a fleet and set sail across the North Sea for Denmark. The trouble was, his fleet also got battered back by violent storms. Now, this could be no coincidence, thought James. He became convinced that it was witchcraft, that a group of witches had conspired the King of Scots' death and therefore whipped up these violent tempests. And so, as soon as he got back safely at last to Scotland with his new wife, Anne, he decided to have all the suspects rounded up, all the suspected witches rounded up, no fewer than 70 of them, in what became known as the North Berwick Witch Trials. And you can see here James personally superintending the interrogation of some of those women who were rounded up and accused of bewitching the king's fleet. And it resulted in many scores of executions. And James was from this time so convinced that he was in the right and that God had appointed him to rid witches from his kingdom that he even wrote a book about it. In 1597, his book Demonology was first published. And as you might imagine, because he's a king, it becomes hugely influential. I would kill for his sales figures. It was reprinted again and again and again, and translated into different languages. It became a worldwide phenomenon. And really, demonology was a code for witch hunting. It was almost like a manual for witch hunting, so that it told you how to identify a suspected witch, how to go about assembling some form of evidence, the witch tests that you could do, and finally, how to make sure that the jury reached the correct verdict. So demonology really was one of those milestones in the history of the witch craze. Well, James now is King of England, as I mentioned, and even though his English subjects had really gone right off the whole idea of witch hunts, of course, you don't contradict your king, do you? So when James is King of England, suddenly the English people try and, you know, make a bit of a show of sharing his obsession. And that's why Shakespeare writes Macbeth, his famous witch play. And if you want to know a great bit of trivia for a pub quiz, that's why Shakespeare makes Macbeth shorter than any other play, because he knows that James hates the theatre. So he makes it nice and concise so that James will actually sit through its inaugural performance, rather. Well, I mentioned that my book on the witch hunts focuses on one particular trial, and I do just want to tell you about it briefly because I think it says so much about the sorts of cases that were coming before the courts. And this particular trial centred on this beautiful, originally Norman castle in Leicestershire, called Beaver Castle. It's pronounced Beaver, it's spelt Belvoir. And it was the family seat of the Earls of Rutland. And the presiding Earl during James's reign was the sixth Earl, Sir Francis Manners. And he was a very enlightened gentleman. He was a very likeable man, actually. Not really the sort of man who would become known as a witch hunter, but that would be his fate. Because Sir Francis had two young sons. He also had an elder daughter, Catherine, from his first marriage. And in around 1615, his two young boys suddenly sickened. They suddenly fell ill. There was no explanation as to why they fell into a sudden fever. They had contortions. They were said to have kind of hallucinated as part of their illness. So it looked to the untrained eye like these boys had been bewitched. And this is where the trouble began. It certainly began for the elder of those two boys, Henry, who died shortly afterwards. And you can see him here in his tomb in Bottisford Church, very close to Beaver Castle. While his younger brother lingered on, he remained very, very ill, but he didn't yet die. And for as long as he survived, so the whispers started to grow louder and louder that both of these boys had been the victims, not just of some random illness, but of witchcraft. And it wasn't long before there were three women in the frame. They were the Flower family, Joan Flower and her two daughters, Philippa and Margaret. Now, they fit the mould exactly that I described earlier. Joan is a single mother. We don't know if she was ever married, but certainly she's not married at the time that she was accused of witchcraft. They are a very poor family. They're not popular in the local community. And you do find, I'm afraid, that many witchcraft trials generate in neighbourhood disputes. It's a handy way of getting rid of somebody you don't like in your village. They live on the periphery of Bottisford and they're said to be of loose morals. They don't go to church and they entertain gentlemen visitors in their house at all hours of the day and night. So, absolute classic description of suspected witches. We don't know how much of this description is based on any real evidence. But as that youngest son continued to sicken, he showed no sign of improvement. So it was gradually accepted by their father, the Earl, that he needed to do something about it. Because it was believed that if somebody had been bewitched, if you kill the person who has bewitched them, then they will recover. So the hunt is on for whoever has bewitched that sole surviving male heir of Beaver Castle. And therefore the Flower women are very soon rounded up. They're found to have worked for a time at the castle. And it's said that they stole certain items of those two young boys' clothing so that they could cast a spell with their cat. Of course, they have to have a cat. That's the other way they meet the criteria. And if anyone's stuck for a name for a cat, I think this is probably the best cat's name in history. They call their cat Rutterkin. Amazing name. Anyway, if you take away nothing else from my talk, take away Rotokin. Well, they are soon accused. They're subjected to various trials for witchcraft, and those trials obviously result in a pretty strong conviction amongst the local constabulary, or the equivalent, that they're guilty. And so all three women set out on the long and arduous walk from Beaver Castle to Lincoln. So it's at more than 40 miles, and it's now in the depths of winter. Well, they'd only gone about 14 miles along their journey when the mother, Joan Flower, suddenly calls a halt to the procession. And she can't go any further. I think she's probably been badly treated. And she says, just try me now. Just if you give me some kind of trial, then I will prove my innocence. Well, what they decide to do is give her a trial by bread, which doesn't sound that terrifying compared to the witch pricking and the dunking in the local pond. But what the theory is that you give a suspected witch a piece of bread that's been consecrated by a priest. And if she can swallow it down, then she's innocent, because effectively it's the body of Christ. Whereas if she's truly a witch, she's so evil that she wouldn't be able to take the body of Christ into her own. And so everybody stands around and watches as the local priest blesses a piece of bread and gives it to Joan Flower. And she puts it in her mouth and she chews it and she chokes and falls down dead. So the story goes. But the story thus recorded is in a pamphlet published after the events that I'm describing. And most of these pamphlets are sensationalist, not very accurate. I think it's at least equally possible that Joan had been mistreated and she'd simply died on the way up to Lincoln. Her two daughters survived, but only as far, of course, as Lincoln Castle, where they were interrogated. They stood firm. They were very brave young women. They absolutely refused to confess that they were witches, but eventually they were worn down. And I think what did it was that they were deprived of sleep. And this was one of the main tools in a witch hunter's arsenal, really, or weapons, because to be deprived of sleep for several days really leads you to say absolutely anything. You just don't know what you're saying. And these two girls eventually did confess that they had indeed bewitched the sons of the Earl of Rutland. And so they were hanged just outside the walls of Lincoln Castle in 1618. And so the pamphlet describing their case was published, and so it went down very quietly in history. But when doing my research into this case, I found something that didn't fit the mould. And that something was actually someone. George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham. Now, why was Villiers suddenly instrumental in this case? The reason was that George Villiers, very soon, just days after the death of that second boy. So if you remember, he carried on, he'd survived, but he dies soon after those witches have been hanged. And soon after that, George Villiers marries the boy's eldest half-sister, Catherine, who now stands to inherit the entire Beaver Castle estate and fortune. She is now the sole heiress, which you might say is a little bit suspicious on its own. Even more suspicious is the fact that I found out that Buckingham had paid for that pamphlet to be published, that very much puts in the frame the Flower women as the main suspects, as the guilty party for putting those two boys to death. I did some more research. I found out that Buckingham had a wise man or an apothecary on his books who was expert at poison. And this man lived very close to Beaver Castle and had ready access to the two young sons of the Earl of Rutland. Well, Villiers knew exactly what he stood to gain if both of those boys were out of the way. There'd been talk of his marriage to Catherine for some time, but he had always procrastinated. Now, though, with the death of the second boy, he suddenly and very quickly marries her and inherits the whole fortune. So you might say it's circumstantial evidence against Buckingham, but it did just make me wonder if there's a great deal more to this case than met the eye. Well, ironically, even though it was a high-profile case involving a member of the aristocracy and James was very closely involved in the Beaver case, it was also a turning point in his reign. Because after this point, after 1619, James really has gone off the idea of the witch hunts altogether. It's said that he's more interested in hunting foxes than witches these days, because he's obsessed with the hunt. He doesn't pay much attention to government business. And he dies in 1625, having lost faith and interest in the witch hunts altogether. So that's the end of my non-fiction tale. But before I end, in another very shameless plug, I should say that as of 13 days ago, my first novel was published, and I'm going to be talking about it here later this afternoon. And the novel is very much inspired by the non-fiction that I have just told you. As you can see, it's called The King's Witch, and it's about a woman at James's court who ends up in the frame for witchcraft with quite disastrous consequences. Thank you for listening.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.